Hey guys, it's your favorite sisters with the Confessions of a Reluctant Caregiver show on UK Health Radio. On the show, you'll hear caregivers confessing the good, the bad, and the completely unexpected. You're guaranteed to relate, be inspired, leave with helpful tips and resources, and of course, laugh. Now, let's jump right in to today's guest confession.
Oh, look, Jay, we came right in mouth stretching.
I know.
I wonder if that, like, you burn calories when you do that.
I don't know. It's almost like, but you know, musicians sing before they start, like, mommy, mommy, ma. That's my way of singing this morning. And then, but, you know, do other podcasters open their mouth closed, like, to get their jaws ready for some chat?
We should take a poll.
Yeah, I know, right? How many podcasters out there are just doing,
You really should watch the video so you can see Natalie and I do a mouth exercise.
Yeah, I feel like we look like a T-Rex.
Yeah, we do. Guess what, Natalie? Hey, we have a guest.
We should do a caregiving podcast. What a novel idea.
Go ahead. Tell us just something special about this guest. You want me to do my voice?
Yes, you can.
It's a boy.
It's always. We've had a bunch of guys on in the last recording. I love that.
I do too, because I feel like they're so underrepresented. And I think it's so rare that they will raise their hand and say, hey, I'm a caregiver too. And it's fantastic that we're getting so many to come out and speak, because once one does, their voice is just so pervasive in the caregiving crowd. So thank you, Chris. That was his breaking out. Like, it's a Chris. But let me tell you a little bit about Chris Schuler. That's who we have with us today. So Chris Schuler is the primary caregiver to his late dad, who was diagnosed with glioblastoma in July 2021. Now, I say is because today Chris says his caregiving continues for his father's legacy and his memory. Mm. You'll learn Chris is a fierce advocate, driven by his father's laughter and love, and a diagnosis that made their entire world stop spinning. And when he said that, Ned, I really felt like that was so much like mom's diagnosis. I never really thought about it like that, but your world stops. What Chris learned during their previous time together, he's here to share with us today. And there's a lot he learned. So, Chris, I'm so excited to have you here with us today.
Yay! Thank you so much, JJ. Thanks, Natalie. That introduction almost brought me to tears. So we're all starting on a good note here. This is good.
Well, I'll get the Kleenex out.
Exactly. Well, and you know, I think it's so important. You have such a unique story, but that's the beauty of caregiving, is that every story is a little bit different, and there's differences for the reason, who the person you're caring for, what the illness is, or what the reason for caregiving is. But it's all about what really connects us as caregivers is that shared experience of care. And how do we take the lessons learned in each of our individual journeys and then like put them together to have this amazing resource to say, this is what I did. And so, you know, people will try it and say that worked for me. Oh my gosh, thank you. That was the idea I was looking for. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I love this. And I love, Chris, that you're coming on to represent the male population of caregivers, mm-hmm. because 40%, that's what they've got on the statistics right now. And we know there's a bunch more. Yeah. We know there's a bunch more. So Chris, we always start off, like I say this every time, we start from the beginning, you were born, but kind of give us your background, give us the kind of set the stage, and we'll work our way up to care, but don't go too fast. Give us a good story.
Sure. No, thank you so much. And you'll hear my dog either barking or jingling here in the background. But and you know, the stats, I did not know that 40% of caregivers are men. And I'm almost surprised in a way to hear that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so my story, we all think we're special, we're unique, and I guess we can make the arguments that we are. And my beginning started in South America. I am originally adopted from Colombia. And so my last name doesn't usually match what people might think I look like, which is a fascinating discussion and exercise in identity. Who are we really, right? Am I Chris Schuler from there, who tans really well in the summer and will never break 5'4"? Or am I Chris Schuler with the German last name, whose parents have ancestry in Ireland and Germany and England? And so I've always found identity to be a fascinating part of my life growing up. And some people will ask, well, when did you find out you were adopted? Well, I never really found out. I just knew. It was something I knew from before I had memory. It was something that was just known. And so I counted myself almost as somebody a little different, I had a special opportunity, and I knew that from childhood. I just knew that I was chosen. Like I was picked to be my mom and dad's son, which is really a beautiful thing to grow up with. you know, as children, we absorb so much, right? And so that was what I absorbed. That was the first thing I absorbed as a child was love. And I was their pick, which was a great way.
We all love to be chosen. That is such, you know, working in the foster care system, there's so many children who feel that they're unwanted because for whatever reason, their parents aren't able to care for them. But to kind of shift it to, I got picked and I was so loved and wanted that it is a privilege. It is a privilege mm-hmm. to get to work with children. I always say that to my fellow colleagues. And, you know, I think it is a privilege and it's a different set of circumstances, but I love that. I love that angle because I think it's very true. I think it's true and I think it's healthy because we all, every one of us in our basic elements want to be attached to someone. We want to feel connected. We want to feel like we belong. And it sounds like that belonging, that sense of belonging really endeared you to your parents even more. Like, you know, absolutely. If you think about it in the future, how did this impact this culture and this multiculture? You've got multiple mm-hmm. backgrounds recognized and honored that, you know, hey, this is what we believe and this is who my identity is. I'm glad we went there first because that's interesting. Now everybody's gonna be like, I want to see YouTube. I can see this dark guy.
That's my foundation. In fact, there's a frame I have on my shelf here in my office, and it has been in my room since I was born, and I've carried it with me everywhere. And it starts with a poem. It's about our adopted child, but it begins saying, "You are the child. You are not the child of our bodies. You are the child of our hearts." And mm-hmm. those words have always been inscribed over my head for a lifetime. And when I became a dad, fast forwarding way far into this story, but when I became a dad, it was a surreal experience because I hadn't thought much about being adopted because that really doesn't define me. Right. But when my kids were born and I looked my son in the eyes and he was the first human that I have known in my life that is a part of my body. We have the same blood. That was so surreal and a really overwhelming. It was an emotionally overwhelming feeling that I didn't expect to happen moments after he was born.
Mm, I love that. I love that. Yeah. So you grew up and you have great parents and you're having child because you're an only child too, correct?
I'm an only child because it was so dangerous to adopt a child from Colombia in the mid 80s that my parents, who were both blue collar New Yorkers, they had never left the country and they got a phone call that said your baby's ready and they hopped a flight, went down there. They brought jeans, they brought stereo equipment so that they could barter to get out of the country. They were prepared. The adoption agency actually explained to them that you will have to barter to get back out. Wow. And when they landed, their passports were confiscated and they did in fact have to barter to leave the country. Wow. And so when they got back and later, years later, when I asked, why don't I have a brother or sister? My mom would always laugh and say, we didn't know what the hell we were doing as two idiots from New York with high school graduate degrees. We had no clue what we were getting ourselves into. And when we got out alive, we were like, well, let's just stick here. We don't even want to leave our kid. We're good. We're good.
We're good. Out of jeans. Out of jeans, man. Let's not go back.
You know, I love that. And so life then, you know, I'm assuming normal childhood, growing up, went to school, graduated high school, went mm-hmm. on, go to college, keep going, keep walking us through.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, lucky to grow up with a wonderful family surrounded by love and laughter and went to, you know, grew up on Long Island, New York, which is a big part of my identity and probably my accent and my attitude most likely. And so grew up there and had a great, great childhood. And my parents, like I said, blue collar. My mom was a school secretary. My dad worked in a sewage treatment plant, a very dangerous line of work that I recognized early in life. And I was lucky to have an opportunity to go to college and they had not been to college. So that was a big deal. And I went up to college in Rhode Island where I met my future wife. Within minutes of moving in, I meet the girl in the dorm next to me, in the dorm room next to mine, and fast forward, she becomes my wife. And so we make our life.
Oh, I love that.
That's like, she's the one.
Oh, yeah. Don't you love that? I love how fate just kind of, or I say God puts you right mm-hmm. next to where you need to be. And
crazy.
So I love that. And so going through school, find the love of your life, you get married, and kids come next, I'm assuming?
Yeah, why? Yeah. You know, I thought she would love to live in New York. I was dead wrong. She was a Rhode Islander at heart, and so she was never going to leave the state. And so we made our life here, and I got into the nonprofit sector in youth development and just started working. You know, my mom always told me growing up, this is what you do in this order, right? You go to school, then you get married. You don't have kids before you get married.
That is our family as well. Sorry to anybody who went out of order, but I mean, my mother always said a wedding story comes before a baby story on TLC.
Yes.
There's a reason.
Yes. Amen. That is absolutely true. And so we just began our lives together, and my wife became a teacher, and we eventually found a house. We moved in. Life was just moving along. We were doing the things that we were supposed to do, right? The things I think that we're all meant to do. And I convinced my mom and dad to move out of Long Island, New York, and move north to Rhode Island. Nobody does that, by the way. No, ask any New Yorker or any New Englander. They don't go north. They go south. Because south makes sense. South is cheaper.
South is warm. South is warm.
It's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. So we buy this house in a nice little neighborhood here in Rhode Island. And my parents are looking at places in Florida and South Carolina. They're talking about retirement. They were lucky to have both been civil servants so they could retire at 55. Yeah. And we're looking at houses, and my dad, he'd love to be on like the real estate websites, right? And so he finds this house about six houses down the street from mine. And it's beat up. It is old. It's been abandoned for 5 years, but it's on a lake. It's on a beautiful lake. Now, we couldn't afford a house on the water, so we're not on the lake. But he saw this thing, and they made a visit up here, and that was it. It was meant to be. So they retired here, six
houses
down the
street. They retired up north with more snow.
More snow.
And cold.
And he hated the cold.
So I do have a question. So, you know, in your bio, you wrote, "I was surrounded by love and laughter. My dad was my best friend." You wrote all this in your bio, and your parents are moving like six houses down. And I lived really close to my parents for quite a while. It wasn't a bad experience, actually. I always say when there was buy one, get one free at the store, I was the free and my mom was the buy one. It worked really well for me for so long. Mm-hmm. But when they moved, what was your first feeling about that? Was it like, holy crap, mom and dad are following me? Or was it pretty comforting to know, hey, we're going to have this family where, yeah, we're going to share dinner. We're mom and dad are retiring. I think this is our life. It's going to be good. What was your first feeling with that?
Oh, I was thrilled. I was absolutely thrilled because I grew up in a house where my grandmother lived above us and in the same house. And my dad grew up around the corner from his cousins, six houses around the corner. And so family and closeness, nobody can make the argument that my family is not close. We are incredibly, not just our small group of family, but our extended family. We are all just very close. So when they made this move, it was just wonderful. I was so happy.
So those are things that are really nice.
It also depends what kind of family you grew up with and the people and the relationships you have, right? Because, you know, we all know people who can't wait to get away, and rightfully so, right? So in a way, you, Natalie and JJ, we're very fortunate to have had that kind of a family where we actually want to be closer. We don't want to be apart, right?
Yeah, I couldn't agree with that more. So this, I think, will segue into our next section. So we will be right back.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
If you see the letters AIDA, do you immediately think of the opera by Verdi? AIDA is also an advertising acronym for those iconic Mad Men days. A is for attention, I is for interest, D is for desire, A is for action. This process is a timeless truism for making a sale. Fortunately, if your product or service is health-related, we can offer you guaranteed access to a global audience with a high interest in health, healthy lifestyle and contemporary well-being. UKHealthRadio.com has a regular monthly audience of around 1.5 million health-conscious people. And Health Triangle, its award-winning monthly magazine, has around 20,000 paying subscribers. Find out more about both at UKHealthRadio.com. Let's all put health first.
Hey, are you tired of the irritation you get down there from pads and other bladder weakness products? Tena Sensitive Care Pads are the first ever bladder weakness pads enriched with a skin comfort formula. The skin-friendly layer in combination with the soft, 100% breathable materials helps protect intimate skin from irritation. And as always, you have triple protection from leaks, odor, and moisture. Gynecologist tested and dermatologically approved by the Skin Health Alliance. Look for Tena Sensitive Care Pads with a skin comfort formula online and in stores now.
UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good.
All right, everybody, we are back here with Chris Schuler, the German last name with the Colombian descent, which I love.
He's a German in a Colombian body.
So with a great tan. So here's my question. You are raised in this family that's close and in proximity and all of this. Were you ever, during this time, did you see caregiving that you really didn't think about because of family relations? Was there taking care of one another? Did you see that with your elders or, you know, what did you see growing up?
The example my parents set for me is the example that I have lived by. Mm-hmm. And when I believe maybe I was about second or third grade, I got kicked out of my bedroom and I had to give it up to grandma and not the grandmother who lived upstairs. My other grandmother. So my grandmother had some surgery done and was having some health issues. And so I moved in to my parents' room and my grandmother moved into my room. And so that was at a very young age. And I remember it was a transition of, I was a little kid. And then when she moved out and was, you know, got healthy again and moved back to her home, I got my room back and we restored it. That was probably my first introduction to the role of a caregiver and the role of a parent-child relationship that's your job. That's what we do. We take care of our parents. And so she came in, moved out. Nana, who lived upstairs through at the same time, when she got ill around 97 and she had cancer, she had esophageal cancer, she had stomach cancer, we were right there. And so my dad now and my mom would go upstairs and care for her, as would his siblings who live very close by. And there was this constant revolving door of people coming to care for her. And I remember sleeping upstairs with my dad. We slept on the living room floor a couple of times when Nana was having trouble breathing or coughing at night. And that's just what we did. It wasn't even a discussion. Dad was going upstairs to sleep on the floor and I tagged along. We had our sleeping bags and I was nervous for her, but I was not nervous because I knew my dad was there and nothing could throw him and he would take care of everything.
And he did. And so when does care kind of come into play? Because you've got your career going, you're doing great things. I mean, you've got a really successful career.
So caregiving started almost immediately when they moved here because my mother was diagnosed a second time with breast cancer. She had had breast cancer when I was a child, and it was almost a quiet experience because they did not want to scare me. And she went through only radiation at the time, and she became a survivor, right? And then when they moved here, it was very exciting. As I said, I was thrilled. It was a big deal. She, during the move process, she's diagnosed a second time, which delayed the move slightly. And I remember going down to Long Island and taking her to the treatments that I could in between taking off of work. But dad really, he took care of her. I mean, he did everything for her. And that's when all of a sudden I saw caregiving through a different lens. I saw it as a child. I saw it as a teenager. Now I'm seeing it as a young man, not a dad yet, but a young man working in my first job. And so thankfully, she is now a two-time breast cancer survivor. And they move here and they buy a boat. And we don't have kids yet, but we are spending all of our time with them. I'm an only child and I'm lucky that I love my parents. So we spend a lot of time and we've got dinner there every Sunday, Saturday, Friday, whatever. And any nights they say, come over dinner, we're there. My life falls down here. And so we now are experiencing this wonderful, they're enjoying retirement and we're just thrilled.
And your parents were blessed. I want to jump in here. They were 55. I mean, I call that really young, but they're young and retired. Mm-hmm. So that is, I mean, they're still very, very active. And so
they're active. They're going, they went on a couple of cruises with friends to Alaska, to Hawaii. They really were enjoying their time as retirees. And when my kids came along, my son was born in 2016, my daughter in 2018, they took such an active role in raising my kids because my wife and I had to go back to work. And in fact, I'll also add, when my son was born and the prospect of me going back to work or somebody, we had to do something with our kid after a few months. I was now a new dad. And the first thought I had was, there's no way in hell I'm leaving this kid. I will not, even with my parents, I love them, but I want to be with my son. And so I actually took a year and a half away from my career just to be a stay-at-home dad.
Wow.
Which was why I would never have thought I would do that in my life. But I was just so in love with this little baby boy that I'm like, I'm not going anywhere.
I love that.
I'm staying.
Oh, I love that.
I love that because it's really what it is. And so life's moving along. Mm-hmm. And then what's the trigger that gets you into care?
Yeah. So in July of 21, my dad had had been retired here, living on this pond, this lake for 9 years. My kids were 3 and 5 years old, and life was perfect. I guess you could call it picture perfect. We're not rich. We're, you know, we deal with our fair share of challenges, but life was perfect because I had everybody I loved around me. And I was over at his house right after July 4th holiday, where we have a big party every year. And we noticed on July 4th, he was a little quiet. A couple people came to the house and his dog was losing her mind barking. And he didn't get up from the couch to like quiet her down. He just kind of sat on the couch. It seemed weird to me, but looking back, it was probably the first symptom that I saw. A couple days after the 4th, I was over there helping clean the yard, had a big backpack blower on, and it's loud, and a new neighbor just moved in across the street. I turn off the blower, we walk across the street, my dad and I, and we're having a conversation introducing ourselves, and my dad paused in his sentence talking to this neighbor, and it was an awkward pause. It was just, you know, when you know someone and you know their tone and their cadence and their speech, when there's a pause like that for no apparent reason, something was weird, and we said our goodbyes. I went home, and that night I called him. Rob's sitting right at this desk, and I called him on my cell, and I was like, hey, are you feeling okay? And he said, yeah, I'm fine. I said, okay. I hung up the phone. I called him. 2 seconds later, I redialed, and I said, yeah, I know you just said you're fine, but are you feeling okay, Dad? And he paused for a moment, and he said, I'm confused. And that's not him. That was not him. That was not normal. And that's when I knew something seriously wrong. And I hoped that seriously wrong thing was something not serious. I hoped he was dehydrated. The man only drank coffee and like vodka. So it's like he never drank water. The man never drank water. I don't know how he survived.
Yeah.
He just coffee. And I was like, I'll bring over Gatorade in the morning and we'll figure this out.
Get some electrolytes. Walk it off.
Yeah. I'm like, maybe this is the sign, Dad, that you got to finally start drinking water. And it was much worse than that.
Yeah. So who initiated the doctor's visit? You or your dad?
Me, immediately. I said, we need to see your primary care doctor. Something's weird, you know, and we Googled everything, right? So we're hoping, oh, it's probably his overactive thyroid. His sister had an overactive thyroid. So like, yeah, it's probably something like that. So there's no urgency. We did not think there was urgency.
Yeah.
Well, Natalie and JJ, in the time that we made the appointment and the 7 or 8 days between getting to see his primary care doctor, he had difficulty forming words. He had difficulty finding the words he wanted to say. So now we're like, what the hell is this? And I'd say, Dad, and he was very quiet. Mom thought he was mad at her, by the way. When I sat down on the next day, when I said, we need to go see the doctor, I said, Mom, Dad feels confused. And I want you to know that you should know that something's off. He's not feeling good. And have you noticed anything? And she said, I just thought he was pissed off at me. So, you know, when you live together for 50, you know, however many years, you get used to your spouse, right? But then you have tiffs, and she just thought he was in a bad mood for a couple of days, which also is not normal and wouldn't have been normal for my dad, because my dad, I in the 37 years I knew him, I never met the man. I never saw him in a bad mood. He was never in a bad mood. He was quiet and calm, but he was never in a bad mood. So in that time, I could ask him, hey, Dad, where do you live? He's like, I live in Rhode Island. I'm like, but where did you grow up? And he'd pause and he couldn't get the words New York out. And as you know, and as your listeners now know, we're all from New York. We're lifelong New Yorkers. He knows he's from New York. And I'd say, Dad, do you know you're from New York? And he'd say, yeah. I'm like, but you can't say it. And he'd look at me and he'd kind of go, huh?
Wow.
I can't. Something was wrong.
Yeah.
I want you to, I want you to tell me about the diagnosis. I want you to tell me the day kind of about diagnosis and what they tell you the prognosis is for him.
Yeah. Well, I'll start the day before prognosis, which is when we had the CT scan. We had gotten to see his primary care doctor. They thought maybe stroke. It could have been a lot of different things. He sent him for a CT scan. We come back home. Again, we're sitting in this office. He's sitting right here next to me. And I am filling out a form to have him go see a neurologist. And the doctor, primary care doctor, calls me on my cell. And he said, hey, you don't need to see a neurologist. You need to see a neurosurgeon. We see something on this CAT scan, and it looks like a mass of some kind. But the doctor, the primary care doctor, is very careful to say it could be a shadow, could be nothing. But we see something, and you really need to see a neurosurgeon, and immediately. Now, he's sitting right next to me, and he's on speakerphone. My dad's right next to me. My dad was a very calm, gentle man, but he had anxiety. He'd get anxious about the most random thing. I mean, if he didn't know where a bathroom was, he was like, I don't want to go to that restaurant. And I'm like, but there's a restroom and it's got a single stall. If I tell him it had a single stall, he felt better. So he had funny little anxiety.
Okay.
Well, now you were just told that there's a mass potentially on your brain. And I look at him and he looks at me and he has no reaction to this whatsoever. And I'm like, Dad, I'm going to make a different plan. We don't need to do this form. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to bring you home and I'm going to make a call and get you into a neurosurgeon. Okay. And he's like, because now we're maybe like 14 days out from the first symptom. Now he's not saying much at all. He's really having trouble finding words. Mm-hmm. And so JJ, the next day, I'm in to see a neurosurgeon. I got on the phone immediately and I blew through any receptionist. I blew through everybody. And I'm like, I need to see a neurosurgeon today. And it was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. They're like, we do not have anything today, but I can get you in tomorrow. And maybe that's because we live in a tiny state, but we got lucky and we got in the next day. And that's where it's tail end of COVID. We're all wearing masks in the office. I'm there with my mom, my dad. We're surrounded by a lot of doctors in white coats, three doctors, the neurosurgeon, the radiation oncologist, and somebody else was in the room. And they tell us, we believe what this is brain cancer. We believe this is a brain cancer, a glioma of some kind. It could be what they call glioblastoma. These words are hitting me, and I don't even know what the hell these words mean. I've never heard of a glioblastoma before. I've heard of brain cancer. And that was the worst possible thing this could be. Of anything that this could have been, this is potentially the absolute worst.
Right.
And the doctor is apologizing to me. The radiation oncologist is actually saying, "So I'm so sorry," in the discussion. And I'm welling up with tears because I'm thinking, why are you sorry? Yeah. I thought you're going to fix him. We're going to fix this. You're going to fix this. He's my dad. He's not going anywhere.
Yeah.
Don't be sorry. And so I was really confused and scared. I was afraid. I was really afraid that day.
What was your dad's reaction?
Stone cold. It was as if you told him that the mail wasn't delivered. He was, the tumor in his brain was affecting his comprehension so much so at this point that he actually fell asleep in the office. He started to doze off during the discussion.
Wow. And he's in it. And if he's 55 when he retired, he's been there about 9 years. So he's not, what, 65 at that?
He's 69. Because they retired, lived it before they moved up. They were still in New York for a couple of years. But then, so he's 69 years old. We had just celebrated his birthday on May 29th. And he was fine on May 29th. And on Father's Day in June, when we took the boat out to go fishing with my son, he was fine. He was fine. And I said, this can't be. He is a healthy guy. He's never had any problem in his life. He's never been unhealthy. This can't be.
So hold that thought, Jay. We have to take a break and we'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list? Then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one super supplement brand, help you achieve that in the most convenient and comprehensive way possible. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, sleep, emotional balance, and more. Benefit from the power, purity, and positivity of our award-winning powder sachets or our therapeutic capsule range. Use code RADIO15 at reviveactive.com and save 15% off today. Super supplements for a super you.
Cappuccino, latte, Americano, flat white, macchiato.
Just imagine, for less than the price of a single cup of coffee out on the high street, you could enjoy an award-winning online magazine every month with up-to-the-minute information on health and healthy lifestyle. Sounds like a good trade-off? Check out Health Triangle magazine on the UKHealthRadio.com website. Just sacrifice a single cup of coffee every month.
Let's all put health first.
The station that makes you feel good.
All right, everybody, we are here with Chris Schuler. And what he just said was, when he was standing there in the office, sitting there in the office, and they got the diagnosis, he had all these doctors saying they were sorry, and he didn't know why they were sorry. Why are you apologizing? You're here to fix my dad. My question, Chris, for you is, when did it flip? When did you say, okay, I have to be strong for my dad? Did it flip for you? And then you say, did they give you a prognosis as far as a time at some point? And you say, I got to take advantage of this time.
I walked out of the room. I asked the doctor to please come out in the room into the hallway with me to ask what this meant. I wanted to hear this unfiltered. And he said, it's not good. These are not good tumors, but if we can get your dad 5 to 7 years, we will. We'll do everything we can. And I said, okay, 5 to 7 years is a different story because the tone was scary in there. However, then we get in the car home, didn't speak much. Nobody said much because my dad can't really say much. And my mom is, I think, heartbroken, trying to comprehend what they just explained to us, you know, because I hate these offices. I hate the way this news is delivered. I had a nice conversation with a neurosurgeon recently about how we deliver this news. And he couldn't, I mean, he's a smart guy, much more educated than I am. After I explained the experience and what I went through, he said, I'd never thought about it this way that you're describing. It's just not, it's cold. And there's no good room to hear that, by the way. There's nowhere in the world that's going to make this softer or better, but there's probably better resources and better tools to equip patients and caregivers as they're leaving the room instead of saying, if you want to check out at the desk and schedule your next appointment, that'd be great.
Yeah, and don't forget your copay in case you didn't do that.
And don't forget the copay. Yeah. And then you're dealing with a receptionist who's dealing with 10 other people. It's just a slop. It's sloppy. So on the way home, I'm thinking a lot. I'm thinking about the number one pervasive thought is my dad not being in my life. My dad dying. I had never considered or thought about the mortality of my parents.
Yeah,
I don't know why. I just never thought about it. And to me, they were young, they were healthy, and maybe that's why. But and despite my mom being a 2-time breast cancer survivor, she faced it, she fought it, we did well, and even mortality wasn't involved with that. But I think his lack of speech, his sudden symptoms were so unnerving and frightening. My brain went in a lot of different directions on that drive home. And after I dropped them off, I cried. Hysterically, I was so afraid. It's fear that I've never felt before.
I want to get into care because you get into care and you do a lot of care, actually. We talked about that. And so at this point, I can tell you my brain completely shifted into almost like developing a crisis plan. All right, so this is what we're going to do. I'm used to taking the lead. We start doing this and this and this and this. And these are all the things, all the appointments that we have to go to. But you've got children, you have your job. What are the thoughts going through about how am I going to do this? Because you're the only child and you're super tight. And what's the thought process behind that? And how do you start preparing? Because you're now kind of almost, and people talk about cancer being war. You're at war.
Yeah. After I finish crying, one of the first places I went was my church, and I dropped in a pew and I just cried because I needed to cry somewhere else. I needed to get rid of and pray. And I asked God for a whole lot of things that he couldn't deliver. And I prayed and I cried and I thought, well, what are we going to do? How am I going to do this? And then giving the news to family members who had a million questions, everybody, it was as if the spotlight was entirely on me. I knew what I wanted to do. And this was immediate. I knew that I would handle anything with doctors, anything with clinical trials, anything with research, off-label drugs, nutrition, holistic medicine, I will do all of that. I will find it because I need to keep my dad alive. This is the most important job I now have. It's more important than anything else in my life. And I'm a dad, so I'm lucky to have a wonderful wife. And even she knew, you need to do what you have to do. And I knew these were the things that I had to do because there's nothing more important ever. This is the monumental moment in my life. And so that's what I had to do mentally was to say, I need to be in full mode to keep you alive. I never looked at myself as like, I need to figure out how to be a caregiver. I looked at myself like, I need to keep you alive because I'm your son and you're my dad.
Mm. So how does your life change?
Oh, everything changed. I was lucky. I was really lucky in a way that it was the tail end of COVID for at least restrictions on in-person gatherings because I was working remotely. And when I called my boss, I think she just said very simply, just do what you have to do. Don't worry about anything. Do what you have to do. So I was able to continue working and continue doing my job. And I was in a leadership role and I had direct reports, but I was able to trust them because I hired the right people.
I was able
to trust them to do a great job while I had to do what I had to do. So I will be forever indebted to Miss Kimberly Dumpson, who was the vice president of development at the time at the college I was working at. I'll be forever indebted to her for allowing me the space to be the caregiver that I had to be.
Mm. And so you did more than just doctor's appointments though, because your dad got to a point where he would only allow for certain tasks to be completed by you. And we talked about that because this is some of the challenges for caregivers when the person only wants one person, and that can be an opportunity for burnout and other feelings and things like that. Let's talk about what that looked like for you.
Yeah. I mean, I went full on. I wanted I wanted my mom, who is also my dad's caregiver who lives with my dad, I wanted her to meet his needs in only the only way a spouse could. I wanted her to love him. I wanted them to have the relationship they had. I did not want her to clean him up in the bathroom. I didn't want her, and she could do those things. And she probably did at times if I wasn't there, but I was there almost 24/7. I wanted to ease it. I wanted to ease this on her because I Googled this disease and I've realized this is bad news. And I don't think she ever Googled this. She just took it one day at a time. And I wanted to be the buffer. Like I wanted everything to hit me. You've seen probably that meme or that image online of it. It's a picture of like a dad or a mom and they're holding a shield and there's arrows coming at them and their kid is underneath them. Yep. That's the visual representation of what my role of a caregiver was. I was protecting him in any way that I could. And at this point now, he's almost lost the ability to speak. After biopsy, he couldn't really talk anymore. So I now also have to interpret as his son and as his caregiver, how do I meet your needs and you can't tell me how? How do I know you're hungry? How do I know you have to go to the bathroom? How do I know you are cold or that you just went to the bathroom? How do I know what you want to eat? How do I know if you're in pain? How do I know if you're scared? Mm. I'm trying to meet, these are the things keeping me up at night. Is he afraid? How do I fix that tomorrow? How do I make him feel unafraid? Because we're not keeping anything from him. We're telling him what's happening. Before he lost the ability to speak, and it was hard to get this sentence out, but we talked to him about the standard of care in brain cancer, which sucks. But we talked about what the standard of care was, and we'd be going through chemo and radiation, and he said, will this help me get my words back? Mm. And that was one of the last sentences he ever spoke freely, and I said, yeah, I hope so. That's the goal. That's the plan. We're going to do everything we can, Dad. And so there's so much, not only physical aspect of caregiving, but the mental aspect of caregiving was so heavy. And you said burnout before. I did not look at myself. I did not think about myself at all during this time. And that is not good. And I'll say that if there's a caregiver listening, which I'm sure there is, it is not below you to accept help. And it is not below you or wrong to take time for yourself if you can, because I couldn't. So I didn't. Mm. But it's okay if you have to, so that you can be the caregiver that you need to be and want to be.
You know, it's funny because it sounds like you really didn't give yourself the space or permission to be able to take that time. I'd say respectfully, I think there probably was a person that might be able to help you with some of the tasks. I understand some of the things were very
sure.
But I think for me, it was about control in a situation that I had no control over. So I would grasp on to anything I could control. And so I hear it feels a little bit like that. I relate to that feeling of, I must do this. I'm the only person who can do this for Jason. I'm the only person who can talk to the insurance companies and crawl up their rear or the nurses or the whatever about what he needs. And I think that, you know, without having my sisters and some very close friends to talk through that and to be able to kind of release that pressure on myself to say, I feel like I'm failing. I don't feel like I'm doing enough. I wish I could do something different and have a good snot fest every now and then. That's a lot to hold in. I mean, how you're sleeping, you're eating, like seeing the kids.
Yeah, I'm seeing my children, but no, I'm not really eating well. And my wife was my rock. And at night, every night at the end of the night, because I would be at my dad's house, I'd work from his house. I'd get my kids. This was what my days looked like. I'd get my kids up and ready and out the door, school, whatever, wherever they had to go. I'd go to my mom and dad's house immediately. And I would get him out of bed, cleaned up, bathroom, whatever we needed to do. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, my mom would do, you know, let's make lunch or breakfast, coffee, whatever. And I'm in the house all day long, helping him when I can. I am there until dinner time. We get him set up for dinner. Then I run home and I have dinner with my kids and my wife and my family. And then we get the kids to bed at 8 o'clock. And at 8:30, I am back out the door over there, getting him up ready for bed and cared for. I lay next to him every night and I rub his head until he falls asleep. And that is my routine. And it was important for me to do that and to be there. I would not have chosen any other way to show up for him. And I'm glad I took that time. I'm really glad I took that time to do that with him and spend that time. Because time is all we have, you know. And I hate to get emotional, but it's not money. It's not things.
No,
it is time with the people we love. And I knew that my time was ticking,
yeah.
And it was ticking fast with this disease. So that was the routine. So to get back to your point of burnout, I was not eating well. at one point we had a visiting nurse come to the house taking his vitals because we had visiting nurses, occupational therapy, physical therapy, speech therapy, we had everybody. And at one point this nurse says to me, I'm taking your vitals next, sweetie. And I'm like, I'm fine. You don't need to take my vitals. And my heart is racing even saying this because it brings me right back there. And she takes my vitals. And on the way, as I walk her out the door, she said, honey, I'd like you to go to the nearest walk-in or hospital or call your doctor because your blood pressure is almost at stroke level. And I'm an Eagle Scout. But I did not remember my first aid merit badge of what a good blood pressure was. And she gave me the numbers. I don't remember what they were, but she said, you need to go to a doctor now. And I called my doctor, and I'm so fortunate to have a great doctor. I called his office and they said, come right in. And I drove right over there. I'm in the parking lot and there was an ambulance there. Somebody was being transported out. And all of a sudden I feel like I'm going to die in the parking lot. I was sweating. My heart was racing. I have never had the kind of anxiety I'd ever had. Like I did that parking lot. I thought I was going to die. And then now in my head, the thoughts are, wow, this is it. Who's going to take care of him now? Who's going to take care of my kids? I'm going to die in this freaking parking lot right now. This is it. And I walk in and they can tell I'm a little shook up and they connect me to some stuff and they calm me down a little bit and I get calm. And my doctor's like, you have a lot going on. This is not easy. I can help you. We need to help you. And they put me on, I don't know what the pill was. It's like a little blue pill. I forget what it was, but he's like, this should take the edge off while you continue caregiving. And wow. I was like, sure, give it to me. Because I didn't care what it was. I didn't even look at the label or the bottle. I was like, yeah, whatever's going to help me, help him. Yeah. And that's what caregivers run into. And that's not good. But I'll also say, I had advice from a lot of people. And a lot of people would say, how are you doing? How are you? Well, I talked to my one friend who's a Marine, and I've shared this often. And I said to him early on in my dad's illness, what was going on. And he gave me very different advice than anybody else has ever given me. And it may not be the best advice, but I will share it because it was the advice that I needed at the time. He said, you need to be a rock right now for your family. You can cry later, but you need to take care of everything right now. You need to do it. You need to show up. You need to show up and put up with it. At first, I was like, F you. Like, what are you saying to me? I was almost like
a total Marine, though. That's a Marine mindset, though.
That is a Marine.
That is a Marine mindset. Like, put yourself aside and get to the mission and whatever the end result is that you're trying to seek, and you sacrifice no matter what to get it.
And that's why they are incredible. And that's why we have the freedoms we have and the safety we have, because there are people that think like that. So after he said that, I started to think, you know, he's probably right. But he also said to me, and if you're going to pray to God, don't pray for what he can't give you. You pray for what he can give you. Mm. And that flipped my mindset of, I need to pray for strength then. I need to be strong. If I'm going to ask him for anything, I'm not going to ask that he takes this disease away from my dad, which is really what I want. I want him to live and survive. But I heard him loud and clear. And so that advice also helped me. It really did. It helped me survive this entire 6-month ordeal.
Wow. So your dad lived for 6 months after diagnosis?
6 months. And 6 months goes by in the blink of an eye in our lives, doesn't it?
Yeah.
6 months is nothing. It was the longest 6 months of my life, and it has become the 6 months that transformed me into who I am today. Because after that, you can't be who you were before.
No.
After an experience like that. And Kerrigan, and you both know that.
Mm-hmm. You're not so the same. Go ahead, Jack.
So that's what I want to know, Chris, because you wrote again some beautiful things about that. Tell me who you are today. Tell us and our audience how it changed you and what you have become.
This morning I was looking for a shirt to wear and my daughter was, we were getting ready for school. And I said, I'll be right there. I got to get a shirt. And I was grabbing a college shirt and she grabbed me a sweatshirt and she's like, wear this. And it said, Dad. Now she sees this sweatshirt as it says Dad, because I'm her dad.
That's right.
My wife gave me this sweatshirt for Father's Day a couple of years ago. And when I saw it, and it was a Father's Day gift for me as a dad.
Yeah.
When I saw this, I saw my dad.
Yeah.
And so who I am today, I think, is who he would have wanted me to be, which is dad. I am dad first and foremost and always. It's not my job. I could care less. It's not any of those things. It is the thing I take most seriously in my life is being a father. That's who I am.
I love that. So, you know, I want to go into sister questions. So JJ has always got her head down, jotting down some notes because she's got very meaningful sister questions. So JD, you want to start with a sister question?
Well, I have so many like moments there. When you came on, I noticed your dad's shirt, first of all, Chris.
Oh, yeah.
It hit me and I was like, and I always have my question, but I always have a comment as well. In the beginning, we talked about your adoption and you said they chose you. But I guess my thought in the whole podcast is that they chose you, but you were chosen for them.
Oh, 100%.
I guess that's my, that is my thought, my takeaway from it is that you were absolutely chosen for your family.
Thank you.
My thought, my happy, my funny thought is there's so much love and laughter with your family. And I feel like that continues to carry. Tell me something that in your memories that you will, that brightens you, that makes you laugh about your dad.
Oh my God. My father was the most kind, gentle man and funny. He was like the Chevy Chase of his family. He was hysterical. We talk about caregiving, and this is so messed up. I'm going to share this story because it's so messed up, but I think your listeners can relate to this. My dad had this great story of he was in the shower with my mother, showering her when she was recovering from a surgery that she had had after a car accident. And she was so the medicine made her so tired that she started to fall asleep in the shower. She's standing up. And so he is like, I'm in the shower with your mother, and she starts to fall asleep, and I'm holding this wet fish who's fallen out of my arms, and she's going to hit her head. She's going to hurt herself. And he's like, yeah, I know you're sleeping. Stop sleeping. Right. And it's hysterical. And to find humor in times like that. And I did the same thing with him. So I would change at night. I would change his clothes. And I mean, he's totally nude, and he didn't care because I'm his son and we're just whatever. So I've never shared this out loud, but When you are sedentary, you get rashes, right? We know this. So he had rashes, you know, around his groin, and I would laugh with him, and I'm like, Dad, I'll do everything for you, but I'm not doing that. I'm calling Mom in for that, okay? So he would give me a little smirk. So Mom would come in, and she'd put the lotion on her hand and start. Well, every time she did it, I would put on some terrible song, okay? I would put on I'm Too Sexy For Whatever. I would put on the most ridiculous songs. And I would get up on the ottoman at the end of his bed while she's putting the lotion on, and I would dance, and he would laugh. I mean, he would have the, and he couldn't talk anymore, but he was hysterical. And my mom was like pissed. She was like, you are the two dumbest idiots I've ever met. And this is how this went every time it happened. And I'll tell you what, it brought laughter into the worst possible situation could find. But I'd be damned if I wasn't going to do everything I could to remind him of who we are. We are alive. And we have to find joy. And that's what we found. I mean, it's ridiculous, but it makes me laugh.
No, I will tell you, I feel the same way. You know, Chris, thanks so much for being with us. And we could, you're the honorary brother. You are the brother we always wanted. So FYI, you have two new sisters, and even the baby would be your sister. She would love you. But FYI, she's 6'1". And so, the baby's 6'1". I'm only 5'10". JJ's the short one. But, you know, thank you so much for coming on and sharing just such words of wisdom and being so authentic and open about the good, the bad, and the completely, you can't make this up. But dancing at the end of the bed to I'm Too Sexy is really going to make the rest of my day. It's made the rest of my day because you need to watch the YouTube video so you can see Chris, so you can visualize Chris and at the end going, I am too sexy for
it's ridiculous. It's the ridiculous chaos of the craziness of what life is and what grief is and what love is. All these things are complicated, but in the end, they're beautiful.
Yeah, they are beautiful. They are truly are. Jay, will you take us out?
I will, guys. Thanks for listening. And until we confess again, we'll see you next time.
All right. Bye-bye.
Well, friends, that's a wrap on this week's confession. Thank you so much for listening in on UK Health Radio. But before you go, please take a moment to leave us a review and tell your friends about the Confessions show. Don't forget, visit our website to sign up for our newsletter and connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, Pinterest, and Twitter. You'll also find the video recording of all our episodes on the Confessions website and our YouTube channel. We'll see you next Tuesday when we come together to confess again. Till then, take care of you.